Brother Gene has been a member in good standing of Local 433 for more than 20 years. So I guess I can say that any brothers of his are brothers of mine. Well, we're here to talk about a political campaign and what it's all about. I must say that it's a heartwarming and exciting experience to travel this country on a national ticket. It's the first time I ever did it, of course. I'm not sure I'd want to do it again. But for a one-shot deal, it is a wonderful opportunity to get to meet and know your fellow Americans across this country. It's an experience also to run against someone like Mr. Nixon, insofar as the issues are concerned, the non-candidate of this campaign. He reminds me of an experience I had with a friend of mine, a young lawyer who travels with me. He took a leave of absence from his law firm to travel with me. But he and I used to be neighbors in my hometown in Maine, and we were both ardent fishermen. And Dick was one of those frustrated fishermen who could never tell the truth. Well, if I came home after a weekend's fishing with a 5-pound trout to boast about, well, he always had an 8-pounder that he could tell me about. Or if it was a 10-pound salmon, he had a 15-pounder to boast about. Well, one night I found out how this all came to be. Unexpectedly, a mutual neighbor of ours had a baby. Late in the night, she couldn't get to the hospital. And after the child was delivered, the doctor wanted some scales to weigh the child, and there weren't any available in the household, so he rushed over to Dick's house and got his fish scales. And you know, that baby weighed 41 pounds. Somebody gave me something the other day that you might be interested in sharing. You know, Nixon likes to write notes on those yellow pages, line pages that you find lawyers using. Well, after one of his speeches in the Western City, a street cleaner picked up a few of those pages, clipped together, obviously speech notes. And there were some notes on the margin that you might like to share with me. There was this one. Pause here. Then there was this one, white brow here. The next one was, use angry fist gesture. And then near the end, in capital letters, this one, argument weak here, yell like hell. I see your members constructing the framework of the future, building the links between communities, and erecting the great structures that house our people and our industry. And I like to think that Vice President Humphrey and I are doing the same kind of work in our chosen field. We are trying to build bridges between groups in our society that are as separate as two banks of a river, but which must be bound together if our country is to grow. Last week, the Vice President and I, a week before last, visited President Truman. We wanted to pay a courtesy call on the hero of 1948, and we hoped to get some sound advice. gave us some very simple advice. Tell the truth. But that's not bad advice in any campaign. It's particularly important this year. And it was consistent with the approach the Vice President and I have been taking from the beginning of this campaign. Several weeks ago, the Vice President said to me, we are not going to out-mix Nixon. And we're not going to out-Wallace Wallace. We're going to tell it like it is. Now, telling it like it is isn't always pleasant or easy. In a year when our country is torn with divisions and uncertainty. As I travel around our country, I find too many Americans who are dissatisfied with the past and too quick to blame others for our country's predicaments. I find other Americans who are frightened by the future and who avoid their responsibility to make plans for tomorrow. To both groups, I commend the advice of James Thurber, who said this, "Let us not look back in anger, nor forward in fear, but around us in awareness." And what do we see when we look around us? We see an America which is now in its seventh year of unparalleled prosperity, with more Americans earning more money and enjoying more leisure time than ever before. Yet, in the midst of this action, we see the other Americans, millions of men and women, blacks and whites, Indians and Mexican Americans, living in poverty, deprived of full opportunity, with their frustrations breaking out at times in violence and riot. The chasm between the haves and the have-nots is
okay.
Someday I'm going to murder the bugler. Someday I'm going to kill him dead. I'll amputate his reveille and step upon it heavily and spend the rest of my life in bed. Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how I hate to get out of bed. So while you're up to Syracuse, I'll take myself another snooze and meet you all in New York instead.
In life, feeling that their jobs are threatened, who believe their tax money is being used primarily to assist a single group in society, a group they feel is competing against them. But let's face it, you in this room and I have a stake in our present society because we were willing to fight for it. And fighting for it, we won. And we remember what the fight involved in the 30s. Fight for the right to collectively, to bargain collectively, the protests, the dissent, which sometimes erupted in violence, at a time when labor did not have its fair share of the fruits of our resources and our industry. Now another group is seeking its place in our society. It is the phenomenon of the economic ladder. When you struggle up a few rungs, You don't want to be knocked off by those kind up behind you. But rather than being thrown off, people can be inspired to climb higher. There is still plenty of room at the top. And that's the story of American society. That every time America has opened its arms to bring others within the mainstream of our country, the country has grown larger and stronger. That was true when we absorbed 40 million immigrants from overseas. It was true in the 30s when labor moved into the mainstream. And it's always been true that in our open, expanding, growing society, we've enlarged our capacity to provide hope for improvement for greater and greater numbers of Americans. That's the theory upon which we've progressed in 180 years. Like a track star, you run a better race when someone is racing against you than when you run alone. A question all too rarely posed is this: what will happen if we do not respond to the plight of the poor? What will happen if we yield to the appeals of a Wallace who says that the way to build safety and security for those who already have a stake in our society is to build a wall between them, those who do not yet have that state? Is that sound doctrine? This has been the answer of society after society in the whole history of mankind. And what has been the answer every time, without exception? The answer has been every time that on both sides of the wall, build hatred, fear, instability. On both sides of the wall, there is no safety or security for anyone. That's what happens when you build walls, and you don't have to go further back in history than the Russian Revolution to know what happens. You don't have to go further back than World War II and its prelude. And what followed, to know what happened when Hitler built walls. The question is whether an affluent America, or the great bulk of our people have a stake in the status quo, whether or not they will build walls or create additional opportunity as the answer to safety and security for all our people. And then what about the war? On the one hand, we find those who are disenchanted with American policy in Vietnam. And they threaten to sit this election up. If we combine them, those, many of them the laboring people in urban areas who threatened to vote for George Wallace because of the appeal I've just described, the Democratic Party and all that it has meant in terms of enlarging America for its people faces an uphill fight. For what? An erosion of law and order. Do you know what Wallace's record is? His state has the highest murder rate of any of the 50 states. This law and order man. He has one of the real anti-labor records of any candidate for president. This law and order man. His state is a right-to-work state. Have you meant what you said to me over this last 10 years about your opposition to right to work. My record is clear, and so is George Wallace's. Which of us is your choice? I say to the laboring men and women of this country, it's time that you looked at the whole record. Anytime I was a candidate, you looked at the whole record. I suggest you do the same with Mr. Wallace. He has no law and order record. He has no labor record. He has no record in the field of human rights, or social rights, or social justice. And all of these things you've told me over the last quarter of a century are important to labor. Well, answer the question for me then. Why are people in labor turning to Wallace? Answer that question, not for me, but for yourself. November 6th may be too late. And as a matter of fact, today could be too late, unless those who believe in the same things that Hubert Humphrey and I believe in open their eyes to the real choices in this election. I think we have to face the fact that if Mr. Nixon wins in November, it will be not because the majority of Americans favor him, but because a minority of Americans have deserted the Democratic Party for the likes of Wallace. Now is the time for concerned Democrats and concerned men and women of labor to make their views count. Now is the time for you to tell the truth to your friends and neighbors about the difference between the Vice President, Mr. Nixon, and Mr. Wallace. Nowhere are those differences more apparent than on the issue of Vietnam. We all want to end the war in Vietnam. We want to make it possible for that troubled country to work out its future development without outside interference. And the Vice President has offered a specific set of proposals on a bombing mode, on an international peacekeeping force, and on a review of our foreign policy alternate priorities. In March, Mr. Nixon said he had a plan for peace in Vietnam. He has made repeated hints on the same subject on other occasions since, but he has offered no specifics. Now Mr. Agnew, always trying to be helpful, says there is not and never was a peace plan. The Vice President has taken a specific stand in favor of halting the nuclear arms race and the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Mr. Nixon says he might favor non-proliferation, but not now. Mr. Wallace, in the selection of a Vice Presidential nominee, apparently has launched the nuclear bomb into orbit. Mr. Nixon's record on the domestic front is no better. Have you heard the Nixon slogan, Nixon's the one? You may have wondered, as I did, what now? Who cast the deciding vote against federal aid to education when he was Vice President? Yes, Nixon's the one. Who voted against adequate rural electrification loan funds? Yes, Nixon's the one. Who was Vice President at the time of the Dixon-Yates contract? Yes, it was Nixon. Who voted to deny Social Security coverage to 750,000 workers? Yes, it was Nixon. Who was Vice President in the administration that tried to kill the Water Pollution Control Grant Program? Yes, Nixon's the one. And who is the Vice President in the administration that vetoed the Area Redevelopment Program? Citizens, the one again. And who voted against increased public assistance payments to old people, the blind, and the disabled? Yes, it was this. And who's afraid to debate Vice President Humphrey? Yes, Nixon's the one. Nixon was a member of Congress for 6 years. There isn't a single piece of legislation associated with his name during that period. He was vice president for 8 years. You remember that when the president was asked whether he could give some instance of a significant Nixon contribution to his administration, his answer was, if you give me a week, I might think of one. I think the time has come for the major candidates to debate. Mr. Andrews says he's willing to debate me, but only after Mr. Nixon debates Vice President Humphrey. And Mr. Nixon says he's willing to debate Vice President Humphrey, but only if George Wallace isn't there. I say it's about time that Spiro Agnew stopped hiding behind Richard Nixon, and it's about time that Richard Nixon stopped hiding behind George Wallace. Yeah. We Democrats have no magic wand. We don't try to trick the American people into thinking there are any simple solutions, because there aren't. What we are offering is the truth, the willingness to define and face our problems, to offer suggestions and proposals. You have a great stake in this election. All Americans have a great stake in this election. I think all of us here remember World War II. We remember when France fell to the Nazis. Let me read you the explanation in that fall from one of France's illustrious leaders. He said this: our spirit of enjoyment was greater than our spirit of sacrifice. We wanted to have more than we wanted to give. We spared effort and met disaster. Now I hear over and over again from too many people, including some in labor, that there are no differences between these three candidates. I'm appalled when I hear that. There are two candidates whose campaigns are based upon appeal to fear. The fear of Americans who have, of those Americans who have not. It's as simple as that. Fear and division. Americans against Americans. There's only one presidential candidate who believes in appealing to the instinct of Americans to unite. And that's Hubert Humphrey. Either of the other two, the basic decency, goodness, compassion, understanding, intelligence, public dedication that Hubert Humphrey reflects not only in his face, but in a record of a quarter of a century of working to make America a better place for grassroots Americans. You know that record because you follow it. As members of unions, you've made it your business to follow. So you are in a position that no other American child, telling the uninformed that record. And it's that approach to our public problems today which we must have in the next 4 to 8 years if we're to continue to be a united country. We have our choice in this election. We can be a continuing, open, expanding, growing society of increasing opportunity, or we can become, as a result of this election, I can't comprehend those who are inclined to stay home. I can't comprehend those who don't see this issue. All you have to do is listen to what the candidates are saying and accept them at face value. If you people in labor who've gone through this kind of a struggle yourself cannot see this, you people in labor cannot organize and mobilize your resources and your spirits to fight on the right side of this issue. From coast to coast, and from one corner of this country to another, then our country is indeed trouble. Vice President and I meet deeply that the road America has traveled for 180 years is the right road. And we're going to say that to the American people from now until November 5th, with every breath we have, with all the energy we have, and by all the media that our resources make it possible for us to use. He and I working together are not enough. We need and we ask your help. If you can't give it to us, we won't have enough help on November 5th. We dread, and you ought to dread, what could happen as a result. This is not a message of doom. It is not a message of gloom. It is a message which I hope can communicate to you my concern about what the real issue is in this campaign, so that in time we can mobilize all of you who want a united America to go to the polls and vote right on November 5th. Because there are enough Americans who have that concept of what America represents to do the job on November 5th if we can open their eyes, get them moving on the road and in the polling booths on November 5th. That's your job and mine. I ask your help.